Happy December, everybody, and welcome back to Dan Has a Plan, Beyond the Balance Sheet. I'm Daniel B. Smith, a financial advisor on the Family Wealth Management team at UBS Financial Services. We're located in Paramus, New Jersey, and can be reached at daniel.b.smith@ubs.com. I'm joined by my daughter, Alana J. Smith.
Happy December, everybody.
Our guest today is Rebecca Gutterman. Rebecca is a registered dietitian at a New York City cancer hospital. She's not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, and her views are her own.
She's fantastic.
She is.
So a lot of people have nutrition on the mind, especially going into this holiday season and into the new year.
They certainly do. So you're ready?
I'm ready.
One thing I think is both a safety thing and a health thing is don't drink and drive.
Because a lot of people are going to holiday parties.
Given the choice, when you have to get home from a party, if you've had even one drink, don't drive.
Just don't do it.
Don't do it.
Do you think people should have a nest egg for Ubers during this month?
Most certainly. Either an Uber or phone a friend.
Or phone a friend. You could even pay them as your personal driver. That's financial tip number one.
Yeah. Most people are in good spirits in the holidays. And if it comes down to safety, I think that's an easy ask for any good friend or family member. So this isn't pertaining to the holidays, but it is pertaining to our episode. One of the things that I've tried to apply in my lifetime is when I go shopping for food, which is now a little bit more rare, but when I was a younger adult, I did. Don't shop hungry.
What happens to your wallet?
It shrinks. It shrinks.
That's good advice, Dad.
Well, I'm just saying, okay, if you're going to go shopping, do it after breakfast, after lunch, or after dinner.
When you're thinking clearly.
Correct.
Stick to the budget. Okay, great. And what's tip number three?
Tip number three is not going to be a big hit with the restaurant owners, but listen, eat home more and dine out less.
Yeah.
It's cheaper and it's healthier.
Rebecca talks about that too. And it's not like you're saying don't ever go out.
Yeah. And I feel if when you do go out to eat, it should be more of a special thing as opposed to a routine.
Right.
Those are the big three Dan Smith hits here in this episode. Usually this episode is after the new year, kind of in the new year's resolution area. But I think Rebecca really has a lot of good information and gets us thinking for the new year.
Yeah. And you know what that sounds like to me?
Tell me.
A good plan.
It is a good plan. It's definitely a good plan. Happy holidays to everybody.
Happy holidays. And here is Rebecca Gutterman.
Do I have questions for Rebecca?
Enjoy how it goes. I'm very excited to be here and looking forward to the conversation.
Great. We're so excited to have you.
Yeah, it's common when I meet with clients that we talk about health.
Of course.
You know, food is important from the day we come into the world to the day we leave the world, and invariably is complementary to a long financial plan. I do financial planning, generally speaking, regardless of health, out to age 95 and beyond. And every time I meet with a 75-year-old, I add one more year to 96, 97, so on and so forth. So longevity is a part of what I do. And I talk to them about, tell me about your day-to-day. You know, what do you do for exercise?
They're like, we thought we were just going to talk about stocks and mutual funds.
You can't enjoy them unless you're healthy.
It's true.
So dietitian Rebecca.
Yes.
The age-old question is this, for me anyways, metabolism.
Oh.
So going back in time when I was an active young man and playing three sports in high school, eating just about anything I wanted. And then I noticed at age 18, I used to be able to knock down a large pizza without a problem that, oh my God, pounds are starting to be put on. I said, whoa. So tell me how metabolism changes over your lifetime.
It is a great question. And it does change over your lifetime. But it's also looking at the bigger picture. You mentioned that you were doing three sports back at age 18. I would ask the question, how active are you today? A lot of people look to and blame food for all of their woes, but don't take the time to evaluate the other things in life that have changed besides just age. Our bodies do start losing lean muscle mass after the age of about 30. So unless we are physically active every year to counteract those losses, we are going to lose lean muscle mass and likely gain some fat mass. Mm. So those changes slow the metabolism. I will say specifically for women, after menopause, that muscle loss does accelerate. So there are a lot of postmenopausal women who say, I swear I don't eat any more than I did 5 years ago, but now I just can't get rid of this stubborn belly fat. And that is due to significant changes in hormone levels and distribution of fat versus lean body mass.
It's the whole picture.
Yeah.
It is the whole picture.
Kind of like your finances, right?
A little bit.
Yeah, it always depends.
Tell us how you got interested in your profession.
Absolutely. So it actually started back in high school.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
So Rebecca and I went to the same high school. Did you know that?
I wasn't aware.
I know. Mm-hmm. We go back.
I was not aware.
Okay. Yeah. So back at a high school that we won't name, but great public high school.
Private public high school. I was in an AP biology course. The teacher gave us a paper on metabolism, basically the biology behind what we eat. And it was really the first time that I connected eating something, putting something in my mouth, to what it does after that. I had never really thought much about food besides the taste of it, the enjoyment of it. I didn't think of the micronutrients and the digestive processes that go on internally. And that kind of spark between the connection of food and biology and health really was intriguing to me. I joke that I always loved food. Who doesn't, for the most part? But it was really the connection with food and science that got me into this field.
All right, we're happy you're there. I hear the term superfoods a lot. So can you describe to us what a superfood is?
Well, yeah, especially because your specialty is in oncology nutrition and cancer prevention. And I think superfoods come up a lot in that, right?
Yeah. So superfoods do come up a lot. It's definitely a trendy buzzword. Truthfully, I don't know if there's any scientific definition behind it. So I think it gets thrown around a lot as something that's trendy and we should all be eating superfoods. My definition of it would be something that is great for you, something that is full of nutrients or that's nutrient dense. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily calorie dense. Our diet patterns are so high in processed foods, foods that are high in calories and have such little to no nutritional value. So I would say that's the opposite of a superfood.
Mm-hmm. When we hear the word diet, which I think is it's a tricky word, okay? So you can say, this is what I eat, that's my diet, or I'm on a diet and this is what I eat. There's two different ways of looking at it.
Right.
So if you're a normal, healthy person, male or female, do you recommend 3 meals a day? Do you recommend smaller meals throughout the day? If you had a blank slate and you wanted to put up the perfect diet plan.
Yeah. So I do like to think of diet in the first part of what you said, as the diet is the way we eat, not I am on a diet. So thinking about it as the way we eat, we could also think about it as a whole lifestyle. It's how we choose to view food, how we choose to consume food, where, when, with who, all of those things that are part of a healthy diet and part of a healthy lifestyle. And thinking about financial health, that's part of a healthy lifestyle to be mindful with your finances and everything that comes along with it. In terms of diet, it again, really looking at the way we eat and what works for the individual. I think it's so prevalent to hear about nutrition information, and it seems like a one-size-fits-all approach, but it is so far from that. Truly healthy eating and figuring out what that means is, what does it mean for you? And what it means for you, Dan, versus you, Alana, those are two different answers. So maybe for Alana's lifestyle, eating every 2 to 3 hours in small portions with more food that you could travel with or you could easily prepare quickly would work. Maybe for you, Dan, 3 meals a day that you could sit down to and eat in a slightly larger portion could work for you. So it's really about the bigger picture of what does your diet and lifestyle look like.
Yeah, well, I always say that every financial plan is different. There's no one financial plan that fits all.
Exactly.
Okay, so how about I ask some foundational diet questions?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. The 3 things that I know, okay, are carbohydrates, protein, and fats.
Mm-hmm.
And can you just explore each of those, why each is important to us?
Absolutely. So you named 3 food groups. To that, I would add fruits and vegetables. Dairy is another one. So when we think about the foods that we want to eat a lot of, what foods do you think those are, or what groups?
Carbs.
Well, if only.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I grew up in upstate New York. You know, I grew up in a lower middle class family where, you know, the food budget with four boys and mom and dad was a healthy chunk of dad's paycheck. Let's put it that way. Okay. So, for example, I would have at least a quart of milk a day, at least. Okay. I can remember having French toast for lunch.
Okay.
And I can remember for dinner, we would call it goulash, loosely called goulash. Goulash was basically leftovers of everything that was in the fridge with elbow macaroni and marinara sauce.
That's so scary.
So, and that's not including snacking in between meals. And of course, my mom had a sweet tooth, so brownies. So that's how I grew up. Okay.
Then I tell her how I grew up, which was very different.
There you go. Okay.
And definitely fruit and vegetable heavy. I didn't really like milk, so milk wasn't really in the picture, but that was just like a taste thing. Really balanced meals, like a protein, a carb, a fat, big vegetable portions.
And guess who had to eat along with her?
Yeah. So you got better.
So I got better. So, you know, I went from whole milk to skim, which is like drinking a milkshake down to kind of watered
water.
It was horrific. But now I'm used to it.
Yeah, but I do love carbs. So there is that taste value.
Absolutely. And I think being realistic means that we're not going to eliminate any one of those food groups entirely. And certain diet patterns and things that you might read online would say, oh, no carbs at all, high fat. The truth is, healthy nutrition advice is pretty boring. Eat your fruits and vegetables has been said to us since elementary school. It's not a new flashy diet trend, but it is really the sound nutritional advice for vegetables to make up a good portion, if not the majority, of your meal. Yes, you could have some carbs, ideally whole grains or higher fiber starches. And then a nice portion of lean protein is also part of a healthy, balanced meal. I will say that healthy eating does not have to be expensive. I take offense to the statement eating healthier is more expensive, because it really is not if you break it down. There are ways to eat healthfully on a budget. So for example, dried beans and lentils might not be at the top of everyone's mind for groceries, but a really inexpensive, great plant-based, healthy protein source. Frozen vegetables are another thing that I often encourage people to include in their regular grocery shop, because they last longer, they could be readily accessible, they're often less expensive than fresh produce. And same thing with fruit. Frozen berries are much less expensive than fresh berries. So we could still get the same vitamins and nutrients from frozen, plain produce that we can from the fresh produce. So it's a good way to increase the nutritional value of our meals to incorporate some of those things.
That's awesome.
A lot of my clients have mentioned to me that they really don't like cooking, so they do eat out quite often. And what are the challenges with eating out?
Definitely the expense of it. Eating out, you are going to get a lot more fat added to that meal with the butter or the oil that the kitchen uses in the restaurant compared to what you would use at home. You're going to get a lot more salt in that meal as well, because chefs are notoriously heavy-handed with salt. They're not thinking about your blood pressure. They're thinking about the quality and the taste of the meal.
Have you ever watched Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat?
I have not, but I've heard of it.
Have you heard about the salt? She just takes like handfuls of it and throws it. I've never seen anything like it. I'm sure it's delicious, but
I'm sure it's delicious. I think it was Anthony Bourdain in Kitchen Confidential that said most restaurant meals have an entire stick of butter in them.
Wow.
So think about how much less you would be getting if you are eating at home. And when we're out to eat, we're more inclined to indulge. Maybe we have the bread that's on the table that we wouldn't normally have at home either. Maybe we have the fried dish because it sounds so good. Add an alcoholic beverage to that. It does add up in expense. It adds up in calories, usually adds up very quickly in carbs. So finding a balance between dishes that are quick and easy to make at home on a weeknight when you're short on time, when you don't want to be standing in the kitchen, and eating out occasionally when that might be the only option. I think there is a balance that could be found there.
When you're customizing per person that you're working with, do you often find they're saying, I just don't have the time, or I'm always on the run, or I have to go out with clients?
Very often, yes. And within no time, I often say like batch cooking. So you're cooking for more than just that one meal at a time, keeping homemade free cooked foods in the freezer for those nights that you're running late and you're short on time. Mm-hmm. Those are some of my big recommendations. Planning ahead. Certainly, it takes some time up front, but if you could meal prep for the week or if you could batch cook on the weekends, that's going to help you out on those busier weeknights. So there's usually some sort of answer to a lot of the excuses that I will be getting.
Yeah.
And then being realistic, saying that if you are going to eat out, how could we make a slightly healthier choice? If it's somebody who does eat out with clients a lot, because I've heard that, it's really looking at the menu. Maybe we avoid the crispy chicken and we go for the grilled chicken. We could still enjoy a meal out and not have it be as unhealthy.
So some of the ailments that I hear my clients go through, one of the most common is arthritis.
Okay.
So if someone is arthritic or pre-arthritic or just has basic soreness in their joints, is there something that you could recommend that would somehow help with that pain?
Yeah. So in that case, I would encourage more antioxidants in the diet. So antioxidants, I would say, are close to a superfood. They are found in a lot of plant foods that are really helpful for us internally. So things like blueberries, salmon, other food sources of omega-3 fatty acids, almonds and walnuts, dark green leafy vegetables. Those are all very high in antioxidants and helpful for that inflammation that's associated with arthritis.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, the idea of preventative care seems like it would come into play a lot in your field. Do you feel like you deal with a lot of people with major issues in real time, or do people come to you with preventative care questions?
Yeah, so it varies. My full-time primary job is in oncology nutrition or cancer care. So I am working with people who have been diagnosed with cancer or are at a very early stage of cancer diagnosis. So at that point, it is treating the disease diagnosis already there.
And there's an emotional element to that too, right?
Absolutely. It's definitely not easy to hear a cancer diagnosis ever. So there's a lot that goes into what happened after that point in time. There are some big principles that can be applied to almost anyone. So there's an organization, the American Institute for Cancer Research, and they have 10 principles for cancer prevention, but they really are healthy diet and lifestyle principles that could be applied to many other chronic diseases. So the first one is be a healthy weight. We know that obesity and being overweight are linked with so many chronic diseases, including diabetes. Exercise and being physically active is another one of the principles. Again, could be applied to cancer and preventive care, but also could be applied for heart disease, for diabetes, for various chronic diseases like that as well. Another one is eat a diet that is rich in whole grains, vegetables, fruits, and beans. So as I was saying, keys to a healthy diet are not flashy and trending. They're things that we know we should be doing.
Do you ever find yourself getting more specific depending on the cancer or the patient?
Yeah, absolutely. Taking a detailed assessment and interview, as I'm sure is similar, Dan, when you are first meeting with a client, you want to hear about their background, hear how they got to be sitting with you. So I will do the same from a nutrition standpoint. What's your usual eating patterns look like? Who else are we considering when we're talking about meals and cooking? What is your physical activity? What do you drink throughout the day? Definitely a lot of questions. Some symptom related, if the person is having different symptoms upon diagnosis, and then creating a plan together.
What's the role of sugar in the diet?
That is a loaded question.
we're leading up to something. I know this show is Dan Has a Plan. So I guess we're going to talk about my plan for a minute, my diet plan.
Hit us with it.
Hit it, yeah. So I've always been very active. You know, I played sports mm-hmm. through college. After college, I was a referee. I did pickup basketball. I've run. I've done biking. And I went to my physician, and this is over the last 2 years, and he honed in on my glucose.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yep. So I might as well be fully transparent. It's currently 7.4.
Okay. So that's your hemoglobin A1C.
Correct. So I do have some knowledge of it now. I'm paying more attention to it now, but tell me what that means for a 63-year-old male.
Did your doctor give you a diagnosis?
He says I'm pre-diabetic.
Very generous of him.
Yep. And he put me on a medication to hopefully bring that down, along with a restructured diet and weight loss and more exercise.
And so this is type 2 diabetes range, right?
Yes. So that's why I said it was generous, because 5.7 to 6.9 is the pre-diabetic range.
So where it all came to fruition, okay, and just to go a little deeper, is I had a toe injury, okay? So I went to my podiatrist.
It's all connected.
To a podiatrist for this injury specifically. And he kept saying to me, I'm diabetic. And it was really, well, let's just say it bothered me.
It was hard to hear.
It was hard to hear, okay? So I will say it is on its way slowly down, but I've had to, as Emeril would say, kick it up a notch. So I'm drinking more water. Not that I drank a lot of alcohol, but less alcohol intake. I'm walking more. I've lowered my portions of what I feel is a pretty healthy diet. So that being said, that's the data.
And this is something your clients deal with too, like all the time, like people in your age range.
And people have been telling me what their A1C numbers are now. Okay. And now I know a little bit about it. You know, I'm amateur dangerous, as I call it. But
I misspoke, so I do want it to be corrected. So the range for prediabetes is 5.7 to 6.4 for a hemoglobin A1C.
Okay.
So anything above a 6.4 really is in the diabetes range.
Okay.
So it sounds like the diagnosis should have been made by the physician. And usually physicians will put people on glucose lowering medications, often in the prediabetes range, sometimes closer to the diabetes range, depending on how aggressive that doctor is. So the hemoglobin A1C tells us our average glucose levels over the last 2 to 3 months. So it gives us a bigger picture than that sort of finger stick or the glucose level on a lab draw, which really just tells you that point in time. But to control an A1C, to keep glucose levels within a normal range, diet and exercise is something that should be noted and encouraged probably a lot more. And the fact that you are attuned to it and sound like willing to make some changes is a lot better than some other people who will say, just give me the medication, and they aren't willing to make other changes and rely just on the medications, versus those people who do want to put in the effort to minimize or avoid being on medication.
Even an A1C diagnosis is going to bring up emotions. It's scary going to the doctor and then having to change something.
Yeah, it's really competitive for me now. So now it's like it's on to lower it. So, and you know, motivation is, I'm sure you see it with your oncology patients, is that their mindset and their approach to their wellness goes a long way. I think it helps. Yeah.
Absolutely. And if you are saying that you're ready, willing, and able to make changes, that's the best state to be in. Talking with somebody, of course, who has knowledge of the diagnosis of the disease and can make a personalized plan for you is important as well. Because as we've established, there's a lot of information out there and it is not tailored for the individual who's looking at it necessarily.
Going Hollywood on you now. So
can't wait.
A lot of weight loss pills are out there now.
Oh, yeah. Also, Ozempic, speaking of.
Absolutely. All Ozempic. The injectables. Yeah.
And, you know, I cringe when I hear it because it's a little scary because they're, you know, it's like any medication. There's like 49 side effects and, you know, could cause this, could cause that. But is there a place in our world for that medication?
I think there is definitely a place. What that place is seems a little unclear. I don't think it should be given to every single overweight or obese individual because it doesn't teach you anything about healthy eating. And I believe we're now seeing that when people come off of it, they actually regain some of the weight that they had lost. And without changing the core of what you eat and how you eat, that's not doing much for you long term.
Many of my clients are living very long and healthy lives. And one of the things I do is I ask them, you know, what's your secret? And it really harkens to a lot of things you're saying. It's not only physical activity, a good healthy diet, It's also having purpose. So as people age, they sometimes lose purpose. So they've been in a very active work career. They had big families that now are sprouting all over the geography. But social interaction is one of the big ones. So you mentioned earlier that, you know, when you're eating, are you eating alone? Are you eating with someone? Do you favor either?
Yeah. I mean, thinking back to likely your client's younger years, having family meals is like a key principle for children. As we age, we might tend to eat on the run more or eat by ourselves more, but food is so social and such a shared experience. So it is good for you mentally and physically to be eating with somebody else. You also probably eat a little slower and more mindfully when you are sharing a meal and sharing a conversation versus if you're just sitting solo in front of the TV.
I have more questions on the oncology front. When you have a patient who is actively going through chemotherapy and appetite is maybe in question, how do you guide someone through that?
Yeah, so that is very common for me, very common in the cancer world. And it's really taking some of these things that we know to be healthy for us and putting them on the back burner. I often encourage people to think of food as nourishment, as fuel, as energy during those times. So maybe we are eating a comfort food of our childhood. Maybe we are eating something takeout that we could just grab quickly and easily, and it's not the healthiest. It's okay during those times, because ideally getting back to healthy eating when we're feeling better or having had a healthy diet up until this point in time, those things are going to be beneficial, and getting you through treatment feeling the best as possible is really the priority at that point in time.
Right. Just making sure you're getting actual calories in,
sounds like. Calories, nourishment, and hydration. Drinking adequately is always something that's really important during chemotherapy as well.
Sure. And I know there's a lot of panic involved when a diagnosis comes through. And you say you deal with families in the sandwich generation. So there's generations of people helping, and Google is accessible, and people are on their computers all the time. So do you advise them to stay off of Google? How do you kind of guide a family through that?
Yeah. So if somebody is at a large medical center getting cancer treatment, they will have access to a registered dietitian. They'll also often have access to supportive oncology who can manage a lot of those symptoms and side effects of treatment. They might have access to someone in the physical therapy world or occupational therapy for some sort of rehab if that's needed for them. So I do definitely encourage people to use their care team, to reach out to me, reach out to their doctor, reach out to those people that they're connected with. And yes, to stay off of Google, because it is not written for you personally.
I have a hard rule to stay off of Google. It does not work well for me. I suddenly have everything in the world.
One of the common responses I get when I speak to clients is that I'm very stressed, either at work or they're stressed about someone in their family with health or other circumstances. When you are stressed, how does that impact your diet?
Great question, and such a hard factor to control. But stress can lead to low levels of chronic inflammation. So we do want to try to control it as much as we can. We know inflammation is not great for the body. There are a lot of things that promote inflammation, and stress is one of them. So whether it's doing some meditation or deep breathing or figuring out the root causes of the stress, there's definitely benefit to reducing it if you could manage to come up with an answer as to what will that look like for you.
Hard for New Yorkers, especially.
So hard.
Yeah.
If you had a chance to create a health dream team, who would be on that team?
Ooh, are we talking like adult people or like categories of
professions? It could be profession, person. You know, when I talk to clients, I try to create what's called a financial team. I think a good certified public accountant, you should have legal representation, you should have a good financial planner. I hope I'm being considered for that as I speak to them. And do you have a dream team, or do you recommend to clients that they have a health dream team?
Yeah. So thinking about a health dream team, certainly starting with a primary care physician, somebody who's going to do that thorough head-to-toe look at you. And I always encourage people to write their questions down and not to be afraid to ask their doctor their questions. We usually see a primary care doctor once a year for maybe 15 minutes. let's make the most of that short time. It's appalling that it is that short, but we need to feel like we could ask our questions and have them answered. And coming in with some sort of plan for that is always a good idea. I will certainly encourage everyone to speak with a registered dietitian, somebody who can take that medical history and assessment of you and your background and translate into it into personalized nutrition recommendations. If you have diabetes or thyroid problems, I think an endocrinologist is really an important part of your care team. A lot of primary care physicians do recommend and prescribe diabetes-related medications, but the endocrinologist is the specialist in that area. I think gym membership or some sort of physical activity plan is also part of that dream team. I know a personal trainer might be financially inaccessible for a lot of people, but if you can do that, that's wonderful for personalized recommendations, of course. Otherwise, at-home fitness or gym membership, something where you are committing to the physical activity part of your health journey as well.
Right. In your profession, where you're dealing with people that are entering perhaps uncharted area for their health, what is an aha moment for you as you're talking to someone who is just diagnosed with some form of cancer or is receiving oncology treatment? Is there an aha moment that, you know, you go home, you say, you know what, I really feel that was a good connection between me and the patient? You know, I always look for an aha moment.
Absolutely. So I try to find that before I finish with them. Usually when we are talking about goals and takeaways from our visit, I like to do a little bit of a wrap up at the end. And I will say, okay, so from everything that we talked about, every recommendation that I suggested, what's one thing that you actually think that you could start doing today? And I will often have to pull them back and tell them to start smaller and maybe even smaller. But when they could state their own goal, such as, I will eat one new vegetable this week, that's an aha moment because they are committing to that. They're putting it in their own words. They're saying that they're ready, willing, and able to do that. Starting small sounds like it's not going to make a big change. But for somebody who has only ever eaten broccoli and carrots as their only two vegetables, if they're willing to add spinach, if they're willing to add cauliflower, that's new and different and better for them. So it could be something as simple as that, that I really say, I'm confident that that person is going to make that change versus somebody who says, oh, I'm going to change out. I'm going to listen to everything that you said.
Right.
Not so confident.
So a couple dumb questions, if it's okay.
Of course.
That's usually my job.
So Dan, you can't go into the pool for an hour. You ate. Is that a wives' tale?
I don't know the science behind that one. We usually try to answer with evidence-based information.
Okay.
But a big I don't know for that one.
Okay. I despise spinach, but if you mix it with mashed potatoes, I'm all in.
Yeah.
So is that just called camouflage eating or help me out with that?
Yeah. So if somebody really has an aversion to eating vegetables on their own, it is still a vegetable if you're mixing it into something else. Adding it to tomato sauces, to omelets, to other dishes that have a sauce to them, still adding a vegetable.
I'm a big applesauce connoisseur, and I find it very helpful with things that I don't like.
Yes.
And there's many.
It's often on the dinner table, the applesauce. Okay. He has his own applesauce bowl. It says Dan's applesauce on it.
What do you know?
Personally designed. And there's no sugar added to the applesauce, I will
say. Correct. It's good.
What is the number one food that applesauce gets added onto?
If we happen to have chicken a lot, and chicken is dry by nature, and it just moistens the chicken. I put it on salmon.
Mom's going to hate this.
Well, I mean, we're just being real here, aren't we?
All of the things that you can add, I would say that's not so bad.
I think it's better than ketchup or...
Better than ketchup, better than mayo.
Right?
Yeah.
So, okay. So we're going to go old school on this one. Feed a cold, starve a fever?
Sure.
Yeah. I feed both, but you know.
That wasn't on the prepared
It was
question.
Not.
No. I'm totally off book. I'm like off road with you. You're handling it so well.
I appreciate that. I did do some research.
Yeah, feel free to take us anywhere you want.
Okay, so back to the American Institute for Cancer Research. Another one of their recommendations is to limit the consumption of fast foods and other processed foods that are high in starch, fat, and sugars. So that's a huge category that really does encompass a lot of food. But I think the key takeaway there is to minimize some of those highly processed foods in our supermarkets filled with neon colored foods and foods that can stay on the shelf for 8 months to a year. I encourage people to think about what's really being added to those foods that make them that way. So trying to eat more whole foods, things that actually might look like they once grew in the earth, is a recommendation that I often tell people to try to follow.
Okay, not to derail us, but it's just so interesting. When it comes to the nutrition labels, it's so hard to know what's good for you, what's not, what's actually in things. And they'll have these labels on the front. And so we just go, okay, that's gluten-free. It must be healthy. I'm just going to go with that. I don't have time to read this.
Yeah. So front of label packaging has changed recently. Combat that a little bit.
Oh, great.
FDA is trying to add like calories and sodium. So there are some more numbers on the front. I don't know if that's translating into changes in national eating habits, but there are different pushes for that. But talking about the label reading, there's a lot of information on there. So I usually like to highlight a couple of key things to look for. First, starting with the serving size. We think a package is often the serving, but the reality is it is often not. Recently, the FDA did change the guidelines for that nutrition facts label to make the serving size more reflective of what people are actually consuming.
Oh, great.
But still checking that portion size is important with serving size. After that, I would say looking at the ingredients is a good place to go. Sugar should likely not be one of the first three ingredients. That includes sugar in any of its other forms. Honey, sucrose, brown rice syrup.
Yeah, so sneaky. All those names.
There are so many names for sugar and so many ways it is added to our food. So looking for that and trying to avoid foods that have so much sugar. A lot of people don't realize, but the ingredients are listed in order of weight. So the first ingredient is going to be the largest volume in that product. So if we're trying to avoid sugar in the first three ingredients, that might mean there's not as much sugar added to this loaf of bread compared to that loaf of bread that might have sugar higher up in the ingredient list.
I did not know that. Did you know that? I mean, I knew it was sort of like you wanted to avoid the first three or something, or like the first few, but by weight is super interesting.
Like if you see a label, it says 5 grams of sugar. Is that a lot or a little?
Great question. The line right under that is usually dietary fiber. So we want foods that are higher in fiber. Often it will be a healthier product if it has more fiber in it. That's not always because there are a lot of foods that have added fibers and more processed things in them. But looking for a higher amount of dietary fiber and a lower amount of added sugars is a good place to look. Also in those new changes of the nutrition facts label is the line of added sugars. So they are now teasing out what is being added to the product versus what might be naturally contained in that product.
What about caffeine?
Caffeine. What about it?
You know, as it relates to blood pressure, hypertension, is it more just every individual is different? Like I could have a cup of coffee at 11 o'clock and go to sleep 5 minutes later.
I could too. Maybe it's genetic.
Yeah, it could be.
It could be.
So I think people's tolerance for caffeine is different. It does lead to increased heart rate for some individuals. It is known to impact sleep and like deep sleep cycles. So having that later in the afternoon cup of coffee might not be the best for your evening sleep. We probably don't want to have so much caffeine at one time, like with a triple espresso. A little bit throughout the day or earlier in the day could be healthy depending on the person.
Gotcha.
Okay. In some of the cancer prevention, a big one that a lot of people don't realize, so I do like to stress, is to limit the consumption of red and processed meats. For red meat, it does include beef, pork, lamb, goat, because those all have a similar amount of saturated or unhealthy fat. And the recommendation is to eat less than 12 to 18 ounces per week and to really avoid processed meats. And those processed meats are bacon, sausage, salami, pastrami, ham, because both of these things have been linked to higher incidences of stomach and colorectal cancers. There's very little in the nutrition world that we could say has a direct link from one part of our food to a disease state. And that is something that has been shown in research. So any reduction in those two food categories will be beneficial, aiming to really minimize the consumption. Limiting the consumption of sugar sweetened drinks is another big recommendation. We consume way too many sugary beverages, beverages with added sugar. So looking to water, seltzer, tea, coffee without a ton of added ingredients, those are going to be the healthier beverages. Unfortunate recommendation.
Oh no.
Is to limit alcohol.
Yeah.
Alcohol recently has been showing up more in research in negative light. It used to be that like one glass of red wine could be good for your heart. Now more research is showing that really no amount of alcohol is healthy. So again, looking at your current consumption, how could we reduce that? That's going to be beneficial.
Wow.
A buzzkill.
Just a buzzkill.
I'll stop there because the other ones are like breastfeed if you are a mother.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Dan?
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I know we went all over the map with you today, but we did
really stretched your knowledge. You're so knowledgeable.
Yeah, she is. She might have to be on my dream team.
Sounds like she should. Although she does specialize in oncology, so let's knock wood on.
Well, she's also preventative.
That's true.
It's okay, right? And she gave me a couple things to embrace my A1C. She gave me some helpful hints.
We're all rooting for you, Dan.
All right.
Yeah.
I guess I'm going to have to commit to a future episode to see, hey, it reduced.
A follow-up. Yeah.
All right. So, Rebecca, thank you for your time. You've been wonderful.
My pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you for having me. Take care.
All right.
Bye. Bye-bye.
So I'm on the clock now.
Yeah, there's no hiding. There's no hiding from Rebecca or your listeners.
So I have many things that I wrote down here that I can accomplish.
It's kind of like Rebecca has a plan for Dan on this one.
Exactly.
Would you say with your clients, there's nothing you advise that you wouldn't do yourself?
I can't say 100%, all right? But yeah, I certainly take a very big college try to do everything that I recommend.
Daniel B. Smith will try anything once.
I do try things.
Listen, we started the podcast.
Never thought that would happen.
Exactly. All right, so we'll check back in, I don't know, let's say 6 months on your A1C. We'll give you some time.
Oh, right before July 4th. Perfect.
All right, Dad. I love you.
Love you too.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Incorporated is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.